In 625 B.C., Nabopolassar drove the Assyrians out of Babylon, and he became the king of Babylon. Nabopolassar was Nebuchadnezzar's father. And Nebuchadnezzar, in 612 B.C., he was the commander of the Babylonian army at that time. He went into Nineveh, which had been the capital of Assyria, and he defeated the Assyrians there. The Assyrians then fled, and by 609 B.C., the Egyptians were going to try to help the Assyrians. And that's when Josiah, who was king of Judah, went there and tried to defeat Pharaoh Necho, who was the king of Egypt. And that's when Josiah was killed in 609 B.C. But finally, the Egyptian army, after it was defeated, Nebuchadnezzar defeated them. So the Egyptians and the Assyrians, neither one could make that alliance that they were wanting to make in order to beat the Babylonians. And in 605 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar had become king because his father died. And when he became king, they were able to take captives from Judah. And that was the first captivity period. And there were three captivity periods, and of course the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 B.C. But in about 605 B.C. is when the first group of hostages were taken out of Judah. And one of those hostages, one of those captives that was taken, was Daniel. Daniel was taken along with other very wise men who Nebuchadnezzar planned to use in his kingdom. Nebuchadnezzar had many wise astrologers and magicians and those who were very bright, who were very useful in his kingdom, but he wanted more. And so he was going to find the best of the best, and Daniel was one of those. When Daniel was taken captive, he was a teenager, more than likely, or maybe just a little older than a teenager. He would have been somewhere between 14 and 20 years old. So he was still fairly young. And remember, his three friends, we know them as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, but their names when they were in the nation of Judah were Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And then the names were changed, and Daniel's name was also changed when they were taken captive. But they were meant to be, in this first group of captives, the one who were the wise men who would be in Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom, and kind of be brought up in that, so that they would develop themselves into who Nebuchadnezzar wanted them to be. But what we find out about Daniel is, even though he was taken captive and taken out of his land, and taken into a land of captivity and was meant to be used for the purpose of Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian Empire, the Babylonian kingdom, what we find is Daniel stayed loyal to God. And we see a great example of a servant of God in Daniel. And that's what we're going to talk about when we look at Daniel today. We're going to learn about him and about the qualities that made him godly. Because there's particular qualities that he had that we all should imitate. And we're going to look at those qualities and kind of develop them out and then apply them and see how we as Christians should be like him, so that our character is like Daniel. We learn from how he responded in this situation. Remember, this morning we talked about being contentment. Think about Daniel, drug out of his land, made to serve Nebuchadnezzar in the Babylonian Empire, looked upon as one of the wise men in that kingdom, and he was put in positions of power along, which we'll see. And yet, through all of that, he remained not only content, he remained godly and faithful to God. And so we're going to see how we can be like him when we look at our character and model ourselves after him. So the first thing we're going to look at in doing this is notice that Daniel was superior. And you can go ahead and turn your Bibles to the book of Daniel. We'll be staying there primarily this morning. And Daniel chapter 1 is where we'll start in looking at Daniel's superiority to many others. Daniel chapter 1, beginning in verse 3, and remember these were specifically taken by Nebuchadnezzar for his purpose. Then the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of the eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles, young men in whom there was no blemish, but good looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans. So when you look at that list of who Daniel was supposed to be, when you look at him being a cream of the crop, as I put it, that's kind of the way we would word that, him being cream of the crop. But the first thing it says about him is he had no blemish. Now, when you think about him having no blemish, there's all kinds of things that could entail, but he wouldn't have had any kind of physical deformity or defect. It wouldn't have been someone who was blind or deaf or lame in any way. He wouldn't have had acne all over his face. He wouldn't have had moles or scars or warts or anything that would have made him unattractive at all. He was a very good-looking young man. He was a handsome young man, physically appealing to the eye. That would have included his face, probably his build, his muscular and strong young man, but he was one of the very best. That's who Nebuchadnezzar wanted. We talked this morning about contentment, when we can't have everything. Well, Daniel had pretty close to that when he was young. He didn't have everything, of course, but he had a lot. He had a lot going on for him. And not only that, he was gifted in all wisdom and possessed knowledge, we're told. And that would be a couple of different things. That would be common sense, and it would also be book learning. He would have had a high IQ and would have known much, whether it be certainly about God's law, as he was brought up learning the law of Moses, but as far as mathematics and the sciences and astronomy, he would have been very well educated in all of these subjects. And having such an IQ and having common sense, again, he would have been one of the best of the best. It says he was quick to understand. As he was young, he didn't know everything yet, and that's what Nebuchadnezzar wanted. He wanted someone he could train, like someone maybe if they're in a craft and they've been doing it for a long time and they do it a certain way, but somebody wants them to do that same craft but do it their way. Well, it may not be good to get that person. It may be good to get somebody else who they can bring up doing it their way. And that's how Daniel was, but he was quick to understand. He could learn it quickly and grow quickly from it to get to where Nebuchadnezzar wanted him to be. And then we find out that he was better than all the wise men in the kingdom, in the Babylonian kingdom. We can go a little bit further in chapter 1 and see that in verse 17. And of course, all this would be included in that, the looks, the wisdom, the book knowledge, all of that. But it says in verse 17, as for these four young men, and again this is Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, as they became known as, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all vision and dreams. Now at the end of the days, when the king had said that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. Then the king interviewed them, and among them all, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they served before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in his realm. So Nebuchadnezzar had all these wise men around him. He had magicians, he had astrologers, he had those who were book smart all around him. And yet he went and got Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they were 10 times better, it says, than all these others. So that's the cream of the crop. That's the best of the best, which he chose. And in doing that, he was building young men to be exactly what he wanted to be in his kingdom. And they had certainly the knowledge of God and so forth. And what we notice as far as all of this is concerned, their gifts are concerned, how did they get them all? According to verse 17, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom. And then God gave Daniel the ability to understand visions and dreams. It's because God blessed them with that. And when they had all of these gifts, Nebuchadnezzar recognized that and said, I can use that. I need young men who have these. And so he was able to use Daniel in his kingdom for it. And remember, in talking about that, that as you continue on into chapter 2, Daniel winds up interpreting that dream for Nebuchadnezzar, that Nebuchadnezzar called the wise men and said, tell me what I dreamed and then tell me what it means. And Daniel asked for understanding of the dream. God gave it to him. He was then able to tell Nebuchadnezzar what he dreamed and what the meaning of his dream was. And that's because, again, God granted him that wisdom. And so when we go down to chapter 2 and verse 28, notice what Daniel does. And this is another part of Daniel. He says, when talking to Nebuchadnezzar, after he lets him know, I can tell you the dream and interpret it for you, he says, but there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed were these. So he gives God the credit for it. He doesn't say, oh, well, yeah, I can take care of it for you. I'll tell you what you dream and interpret it for you. He said, God has revealed this to you, Nebuchadnezzar. This is something that God has spoken. So he is showing this to you. He's told me what it is, and I can then reveal it to you. He makes sure to let Nebuchadnezzar know it came from God. And so because of all of this, because of his great wisdom and his God-given ability and who Daniel was, notice what Nebuchadnezzar does for him in verse 46. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel. Now this is a king. This is one who's in charge of an empire. He is falling on his face, prostrate before Daniel, and commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. The king answered Daniel and said, truly your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret. Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. Also, Daniel petitioned the king and set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon, but Daniel sat in the gate of the king. So where does Daniel get to because of all this? His great wisdom and his ability to interpret dreams and what he does for Nebuchadnezzar, it puts him in a very high position. And he's able to put his three friends in that high position also. And that's because, again, God blessed him with this wisdom and with this ability to interpret the dreams. Well, as we continue on looking at Daniel and his being a superior individual, we notice that he is able to interpret the handwriting in chapter 5. And that's after Nebuchadnezzar, but King Belshazzar is now the king of Babylon, and he's about to lose his kingdom. The Medes and the Persians are about to take the kingdom over. But there is a time when King Belshazzar throws a party. And it's a drunken party. He invites all of these men to come, and he has the women dancing, and he serves alcohol everywhere. And so they're drunk, and they're having a big time. Well, all of a sudden, when this is going on, there is a hand that appears. It says in verse 5, the fingers of a man's hand appeared. And then it writes. And when he sees that, we're told that the king's countenance changed in verse 6. And we're told that the king's knees, his hips were loosened and his knees knocked against each other. This man was scared out of his mind. This king was, when he saw the handwriting come out of this hand just appeared. And here they are doing all these things that they shouldn't be doing anyway. And that's when he needs to find out what the reading of this writing is that appeared. Well, who was going to be able to reveal that to him? Daniel could. So we look in verse 8. Now all the king's wise men came, but they could not read the writing or make known the king's interpretation. Just like Nebuchadnezzar called his wise men, none of them could tell him what he dreamed, except for Daniel. Then King Belshazzar was greatly troubled. His countenance was changed, and his lords were astonished. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came to the banquet hall. The queen spoke, saying, O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts trouble you, nor let your countenance change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy God. Who do you think that is? It's Daniel. Daniel's the one who she knew about, who could come and tell him what this writing is. And in the days of your father, the days of Nebuchadnezzar, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, the king, made him chief of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. Inasmuch as an excellent spirit, knowledge, understanding, interpreting dreams, solving riddles, and explaining enigmas were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belshazzar, now let Daniel be called, and he will give the interpretation. So again, Daniel is able to interpret this handwriting. He could interpret Nebuchadnezzar's dream. He's going to be able to also interpret this handwriting on the wall. Now he explains in verse 17, when Daniel's talking to the king, of what he had done before and what had happened to Nebuchadnezzar and what he told would happen to Nebuchadnezzar. And the same thing is going to happen to him. Verse 17, Daniel answered and said before the king, "Let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another, yet I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, a kingdom and majesty, glory and honor. And because of the majesty that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whomever he wished, he executed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. And whomever he wished, he put down." Now notice what he does. He says, God gave him this. God put him in a position that if he wanted to kill somebody, he could kill him. If he wanted to let somebody live, he could let them live. Everybody trembled at him. He ruled everything. That's the power that Nebuchadnezzar had. But, verse 20 says, when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne and they took his glory from him. And remember what happened to him? He was driven from the sons of men. His heart was made like the heart of, like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men and appoints over it whomever he chooses. So remember what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. He was humbled quickly. Even though he thought he was something great, he was made so low that he was out in the fields eating like an animal. And remember, his nails grew long and he became like the appearance of an animal too and acted like an animal. And he had to come out of that, snap out of that in order to, you know, turn to God and get right again. But he lost everything. He lost his kingdom. He lost his power. People didn't respect him like before and look at him like they did before. His dwelling was not among men anymore, but among animals. So he says in verse 22, "But you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all this." So you knew this story, but you're like him. You are not humble either. You have become full of pride. And therefore, as the handwriting of the wall is going to tell him, he interprets the handwriting on the wall beginning in verse 25. He says, "This is the inscription that was written, many, many tekel at Parzan. This is the interpretation of each word. Many, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Peres, your kingdom has been divided, given to the Medes and Persians." So then Belshazzar gave the command and they clothed Daniel with purple. Remember, he promised the gifts. put a chain of gold around his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. That didn't matter much because he was about to lose the kingdom. And he does lose the kingdom. Verse 30 says, that very night Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain. And the Medes and the Persians took over, just like the prophecy says. Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. So he was able to interpret all that. He knew what that handwriting was. He knew what it meant. He knew what Belshazzar needed to learn from it. And that he hadn't been a humble individual, and because of that he was losing his kingdom, and it was going over to the Medes and the Persians. Daniel was superior. Not just anybody could do that. Not just anybody could see that and just be able to interpret exactly what it is. Not just anybody would be able to know Nebuchadnezzar dreamed a dream, know what the dream was, and then be able to tell him what the dream meant. It's Daniel, and it's because God gave him that ability. So he was cream of the crop in all kinds of ways. His looks, his abilities, his wisdom, all of this is included. And because of that, once the Medes and the Persians came into power, Daniel was put into power. Of course, Belshazzar said he was going to, but he lost the kingdom. And so when Darius became king in chapter 6, Daniel was one of the ones who was set over the kingdom. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom, chapter 6 and verse 1, 120 satraps to be over the whole kingdom. And over these three governors, of whom Daniel was one, but not just that, look, that the satraps might give account to them so that the king would suffer no loss. Then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. Daniel was cream of the crop. Daniel was superior. He was far above these others. Even when he was put in a position of governor and there were other governors, he was far above they were. And think about who Daniel was again. Daniel was a slave. He was a slave from Judah. And yet he was looked at so highly that he was put in this great position of power in this foreign land that had taken him captive so many years before. Daniel was cream of the crop. Now when we apply that to ourselves, Daniel being superior in the ways that he was, I want to suggest to you that we need to be superior Christians. All of the abilities that we have are from God. Whatever it was that Daniel was able to do, all the wisdom that he had, all the book smarts, the looks, everything that he had was given to him from God. And we have to understand that if we're able to do anything, whatever it is that we can do, whether it's helping in the church or whether it's something that we do in our secular lives outside, we're Christians no matter what we do. Everything that we do is a gift from God, whatever ability that is. If there is one who is an artist and they're very, very skilled at drawing and producing art for whatever reason they need to, if it's for their profession, they may just sell the art, but if it's for a certain purpose, they are superior at that. Well, why is that? Why can they do that? It's a gift from God. God has given them the abilities that they have. If one's an engineer, how did one become an engineer? I couldn't be an engineer. I don't have enough knowledge in mathematics to be, and I don't have a mechanical kind of mind anyway. I couldn't do that. Anybody who is able to do that, that is a gift from God. That's their talent. That's what they are able to do. Then you bring that to the church, song leader, where they have talent to lead singing. One who teaches, they have talent to teach. If you're doing something for the Lord and you're doing it well, then it's God has blessed you with that talent and that ability. We need to use those things and become superior. Whatever we do, we need to do to the best of our ability, whether it's secularly, whether it's what we do in the church. We do it to the best of our ability. I want you to look with me in Ecclesiastes chapter 9. I think this passage applies to what we are talking about here, doing something to the very best that we are able to. Begin with me in verse 7 of Ecclesiastes chapter 9. It says, "Go eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. Let your garments always be white, and let your head lack no oil. Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, which he is giving you under the sun, all your days of vanity. For that is your portion in life, and in the labor which you perform under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might, for there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you are going." Now what's he saying? Saying, okay, you're living your life, you're doing what you have to do, you're working your job in order to make a living, you are working in my kingdom as a part of the church, but he's saying, if you do something, do it with everything that you have. And it doesn't matter what you do, okay, if you are sweeping the floor, you're going to do it the very best way that you can. If you're running a company, you're going to do it the very best that you can. What you are doing in your life, you put your all into it. That's what he's saying. And the conclusion is, look, we're all going to the same place. We're all going to the grave. And there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave. So before you get there, you need to be going all out. Verse 7 basically says, enjoy your life. Enjoy your family, eat your food, be merry, be happy. We talked this morning about being content, and it's not stoicism. We're supposed to be happy. We're supposed to be joyful people. We're supposed to enjoy one another. But then we work hard, and we work not only to make a living, we work in the kingdom, and we do so with all of our might. You know, what's interesting is when people could just look at Daniel, they could see that this is a superior person. They could recognize him as superior. Even though he's a slave from Judah, he was very much superior to those around him. He was taken captive for that reason. When they looked out at the young men and they saw Daniel and they saw the others, these are men who recognized their gifts, realize these are gifts from God. Do people look at us and see our gifts? Are we holding back, hiding them? Are we not shining them forth? And that doesn't mean we're going to be showing off. That's not the idea. But it's the idea, are we putting all into it that we're able to do? If God's blessed us with these things, are we going forth and doing them? Or are we letting them go to waste? Daniel was superior, and he used his superiority for good. All right, the second thing that Daniel was is that Daniel was a moral individual. And remember back, we can go back to chapter 1, when Daniel was taken captive, they were fed, actually these men, including Daniel, were fed from the king's table. And that was unheard of anyway, but he's fed from the king's table, delicacies from his table. And yet Daniel refused to eat of these. In verse 8 of chapter 1, "But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself." So he purposed not to defile himself. That means he wasn't going to eat the meat. He wasn't going to drink the wine. And we're not told what was wrong with the meat. It may have been an unclean meat. You know, there were certain things that were clean to Jews and they're unclean to Jews. It may have been unclean. Maybe he had in his mind that this could be something that had been sacrificed to a false idol. So I don't want to defile myself with food that's been sacrificed to an idol. But Daniel did not approve of this meat and wasn't going to eat it. So he asked about it, and they said, well, you're going to have to eat it. So Daniel didn't stop there. He went a step further. When the eunuch declined to allow him to skip eating the meat, he went to the steward, and he asked the steward in verse 11, Daniel said to the steward whom the chief of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days and let them give us vegetables to eat and water to drink." So they were fed water and vegetables, and he convinced them to do that, and they ate just the vegetables and drank the water. So then he didn't have to compromise his beliefs. And then he was able to also have that sustenance, which was healthy for him to eat. And based upon that, we find out that he was healthier than the others were later on. They were found appeared better and fatter in flesh, verse 15 says, than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. But what the point is that Daniel did not give in to his desires. Daniel did not give in to his belief that he shouldn't do something. So this is what we have to understand about Daniel. He didn't compromise by eating the unclean meat. In this, as Daniel was moral, he was. We think about him and his prayer life. For example, he didn't stop praying when he was told to stop praying in Daniel chapter 6 and the first part of Daniel chapter 6. And remember what that got him. When he was thrown into the lion's den, because they said, "Look, if you petition any god or man other than the king, then you're going to be tossed into the lion's den." They knew that Daniel would do that because Daniel was a prayerful man. And so when he did not stop praying, then he was cast into the den of lions. But what we find out in this story before it gets to him being thrown into the den of lions is verse 4. Because the governors and the satraps were trying to find some charge, it says, against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault found in him. So here Daniel is. He was a prayerful man. He continued to pray. They looked for some fault in him. They couldn't find any fault in him, and that's why they had to get the king to sign this ridiculous petition anyway, to say that you cannot petition any other man or God. You know, when you think about Daniel as far as the position he's put in and him being moral, he was a model politician. Because here he was put in this position of power, and he was the model politician. They couldn't find any error in what he did. When they went in his background and they looked, they said, "Well, surely we can find something that he did that he's done wrong, something that we can charge against him," but they weren't able to find anything. So here, you know, compared to today, when candidates, we say, they have to lie, cheat, or steal, or do whatever is necessary to get elected, Daniel was put in this position of power, and they look back and they can't find anything against him. Just like our politicians are challenged today of their past, Daniel was, and nothing was there. And so, you know, when we apply that, as far as being moral individuals, he got to the point that he stayed moral and stayed prayerful and continued that lifestyle even when he was threatened to be thrown into the den of lions. And when he was thrown into the den of lions, what did he do? He trusted in God and he prayed to God, and whatever happened, happened. He didn't know what would happen. He didn't know if God would save him or not. But the point is, he didn't give up his morality. He didn't go back on his morality in order to save his skin in this situation. And when we think about that as far as we are concerned, you know, when we do the right thing, that's not always going to get us good results. In fact, we may have bad results because we do the right thing. We may get fired because we do the right thing. We may lose our house. We may lose money. We may whatever it is. We may suffer because we do right. But Daniel was willing to suffer if he was doing right because he was moral and he wasn't giving up on his morals. Now that's what we have to understand about him. So as we look at Daniel and we see his morality and we see the superiority that he had, we as Christians need to model ourselves after that. We've talked about this last point, and so I'll just briefly mention it. We're almost out of time. But the fact that Daniel was a prayerful individual, remember when he prayed for Nebuchadnezzar's dream, he praised God when he gave him that dream. Remember, he prayed three times a day, chapter 6 and verse 10 tells us. So, was he going to give up praying even though he was threatened to be thrown in the den of lions? No, certainly not, because he had the habit of praying three times a day. When we think about our habit, what should it be? What kind of individual should we be when it comes to our prayer lives? Are we going to be prayerful like Daniel was prayerful? 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 17 says, pray without ceasing. Are we doing that? Daniel prayed three times a day. That's without ceasing, isn't it? Are we going to pray without ceasing? Colossians 4 and verse 2 says, continue earnestly in prayer. Continue earnestly in prayer. Don't stop. This is the kind of man that Daniel was. And in talking about that, and that being his habit, and we are looking at ourselves, what about us? What kind of prayer lives do we have? What kind of individuals are we? Do we have active prayer lives? Do we turn to God for strength, for guidance? Or are we going to give in and refuse to pray because man doesn't think that it's right for us to, or tells us not to? What choice would we make in that situation? I hope that we do learn from Daniel and see what a great individual that he was. And the last thing I guess we'll say about him is his humility in his prayer. Remember when he prayed, and this is in Daniel chapter 9 and verse 3, when he prayed for the nation because the nation was sinful, he put on sackcloth, he sat in ashes, and he humbled himself and prayed to God, bowed down to God. Do we have that kind of humility, realizing God is our Creator and that it is a privilege to pray to Him? We need to be like Daniel in that way also. We can learn so much from this man. And we could go on and on and on talking about Daniel, especially in these chapters. We've skipped a lot and haven't talked about a lot of things that Daniel did. But I tell you, he was one who is a model for us. We want to know how to be godly and how to be content in a time when he's drug out of his land and made to live in this heathen land. What if we were drug out of the United States and made to serve a foreign king somewhere, and the Constitution was taken away and all our rights were taken away? Could we be content in that? Could we live faithfully in that? We look to Daniel and we see what that's exactly what happened to him. And we need to make sure that we model ourselves after him and do faithfully as he did. If you haven't yet, though, become a Christian, we want you to realize that there is a better place than here, than this world, to be. This world is not our home. We're not going to be here forever. That when we leave here, we have the opportunity to go to heaven and to live with God forever in heaven. And we want you to go there. We want all of us to go there. We want you to do what's necessary to be able to go there. To repent of your sins, to be baptized in water for the remission of your sins. We hope that you'll make the decision to do that, to become a child of God. If you're already a Christian, we want you to make sure that your life is right with Him. That you pray and ask the Lord to forgive you of things that you've done that's wrong, and you correct your life and make sure that you're on your way there, and that we all work toward our home in heaven. If you need to respond to the invitation, if you need to correct your life, we urge you to do that now while we stand and while we sing. Have thine affections been nailed to